Hello, everybody. Welcome to A Cast of the Past, the time-traveling video game podcast where best friends get together to talk about old games in a new light. I am one of your co-hosts, Tom, and I'm joined, as always, by...
Josh.
Yes. Things are a little bit different today, but I'm going to explain. We have to honestly get into this quick. We are going to be talking about a game that has been festering on the borders of A Cast of the Past for some time. That game is Super Mario 64. Recently been back in the spotlight because of Mario's 35th anniversary with Super Mario 3D All-Stars hitting the shelves and people experiencing this game on the Switch. And Josh, literally moments ago, just tapped out of a Super Mario 64 Twitch stream at only 45 stars because
47.
Because he was so enraged by this game. I knew this was going to be a divisive episode. I knew this was going to be a controversial episode. But watching that stream, I could tell that Josh was feeling a little raw. And I figured we got to get recording right now. So this is the episode. This will be a little bit less of a history lesson, although we will get into the development history of this game. This is going to kind of be a big opinion piece, a big think piece about how Mario 64 has aged. Has it aged well? Has it aged like a pile of turds? We're going to talk about it today, so let's get into it. Josh, you asked me to lead because, you know, Josh, you're 32 years old. Same as me, but you're a month older than me.
And 2 months.
2 months. And in this year of our Lord, 2020 AD, you played Super Mario 64 for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what system did you play it on?
I played it on the Nintendo Switch.
You did. You played the Mario 3D All-Stars emulation. And I played this for the first time on a Nintendo 64. And I have played it in many variations since. I have played it on the Wii Virtual Console re-release. On the Wii U re-release, I have played the Super Mario 64 3DS remake, and I also own the 3D All-Stars game in the package, which I also played this year, just for a replay. So, Josh, let's get into it. Your first gameplay. Tell me your thoughts. Summarize them as best you can.
So, let me go back to the beginning here a little bit, okay? So this game came
let's
out
go
September.
Back.
This game came out September 29th, 1996, right? So this game came out 4 days after I turned 8 years old. And who would have thought that 8-year-old me was the smartest kid in the entire world to not get this game when it came out?
Oh, here we go.
Like, I don't want to be as harsh on it as I want to come off, but this game is terrible. This
Josh,
was not...
the only way it's Josh, controversy creates cash, all right?
This
go ahead,
was not a good game.
I'm going to tell you how much you're wrong. So
there, was...
Tell me in 3 to 4 sentences why this is not a good game. And we'll keep the passion going. But up top, why is this not a good game in your opinion?
It is one of the worst controlling platforming games that I've ever played. And I played Bubsy 3D.
That's something. What else?
Camera, terrible in the game. The mechanics don't make sense for how he's supposed to be moving. When you think of Mario, you think of pixel perfect platforming, not this Italian plumber that apparently was dipped in the butter before they put him inside of this game. So he's just slipping and sliding all over the damn place. Right?
I mean, Italian food isn't good unless there's butter on it. So I don't see what the problem here is. I mean, all right, well, let me just fidget in here for a second to just throw down my end of this argument. So I've been wanting to get back to this game for a long time. If you've been a long time listener, you know that at one point this podcast ran under a different name before we rebooted, and we had an episode where the two of us and our former co-host kind of got into a debate about what was the best Mario game. And I was kind of passionately defending Mario 64, and you guys were, like, grilling me. And I basically had weak sauce defense for it. I basically was just like, it's great, it's great. And people who listen to the show that we know in real life have busted on me for it. They've been like, wow, Tom, what a passionate defense. It's great, it's great. So I failed to stand up for this game that I am clearly passionate about. Now, am I going to say in this episode that it's a flawless masterpiece that has aged beautifully and is just a perfect game? No, because I'd be silly to say that, and because, as we'll get into there have been better 3D Mario games since this title. However, I stand for what this game represents in history. I stand for what still works in this game. And I'm going to stand against some of Josh's anger to shine some positivity on this title. But this is literally going to be an episode of Polar Extremes. Sometimes on this show, we usually come to agreeable middle points or something like that. But today, it's going to be different.
I went into this game, and this is the thing. I went into this whole stream, this whole, the 32-year-old's first time playing Mario 64. I went into it with open mind. I went in super positive. I understood, I knew that I was going to get frustrated at times, but I want to know why it was a good game. Why people say it's a masterpiece. Why is it one of the greatest Mario games, if not one of the greatest games of all time that people always talk about? And it's one of those, oh, you've never played it? Oh, I can't believe you never played it. Why? After my experience with it, why do you care if I've never played this game before? Because it wasn't worth it. And going in the first world's fine. It's a great introduction.
Bomb Battlefield. Yep.
It's a great level. And music kicks off and it's awesome. The characters, okay, they're good. But there's so many things in the world, in the game, that just I had so many problems with. And I called it out in a stream of, you go in there and you get a star. Okay, you get the star. Now it kicks you back out. Now you got to go back in. Yeah. Now it kicks it back out. Now you got to go. And it's, let me just do all six stars at one time.
Okay, so if we want to just kind of take this one at a time, sure, that's not great. That aspect of the level design isn't great, because basically what's happening is the course exists in one state, but certain stars require certain things to be arranged, or obstacles to be put up, or characters to be generated that aren't present in other stars. And future Mario games and future platformers fix this. Banjo-Kazooie, you can get most, if not all, 10 of each world's jigsaw pieces, which are the equivalent of stars, in one go. Super Mario Odyssey, went on to fix this. You can get moons in any order you want, however many you want, within a world. Mario Sunshine kind of took a step back from this, in that, in Mario 64, you could jump onto Bomb Bomb Battlefield, and if you know how, you can instantly get the sixth star, right away. That can be the first one you get. And the game's not going to punish or restrict you from that. Whereas in Mario Sunshine, it's you have to do the stars in sequential order, because the next level will not open up and not be set up for that shine or that star until you do it. So there's an interesting thing where the Mario series kind of started flexible, got less flexible, and then became flexible again as it went forward. But to what you're saying, you have a problem with how the kind of level setup happens. And I respect that. I get that. What else? What else would you call just a problem? If you had to just narrow down a top three problems. So yeah. We have a little bit of level inflexibility, in your opinion.
Yeah, I think.
Which I'll concede to.
The number one thing on my list is how slippery Mario is. I cannot get over why he controls the way he does. And who thought it was a great way to have him just be able to slip and slide all over the place. I don't get it. I feel like I'm constantly playing on an ice level. No matter what. Even if I'm in the middle of the sand, he's slipping and sliding all over the place. It doesn't make sense. Physically, mechanically wise, it does not work for a platformer. So that was number one.
You see, that's... Oh, yeah. Okay, see, it's interesting to me because, now admittedly, I have this game so embedded in my muscle memory that I know how to steer the game the way I want to. It's like driving an old car. I know every way to best operate the vehicle. But the thing is, I feel at this point in my gameplay experience, it's only slippery if you make it slippery. If you're using his baseball slide or if you're using the long jump, coming out of those moves, yes, Mario has a little bit of a delayed stoppage as he slides across the ground. But if you're just doing base jumps and timing them well, or if you're, ground pounding into a landing to make sure you definitively land where you want to be, he stops on command. So it comes down to how you're playing with the tools you're given, in my opinion, that control the fluidity of Mario's movement.
It's weird because playing Mario Odyssey, like, he controls really well in that.
He does, yes.
And this is completely different. He seems floaty. He seems like too fast. It's not a grounded Mario. The game seems almost over exaggerated.
Right? All right. Well, then I think that is an important point to take things back in a historical perspective. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, this was released in 1996 and it was in development for years beforehand. I know that there had been previous attempts at doing kind of 3D, what I guess you consider at that time open world gameplay before this.
Mm-hmm.
But this was, you know, the first major game to give you 3D movement with, you know, primarily driven and controlled by an analog stick, accompanied by user controlled camera movement. You know, like, this is in many ways, well, not in many ways, it is. This is a first. And, you know, the first version of lots of famous things don't necessarily hold up, but I just feel like, I'm not going to say that, like, again, I'm not going to say Mario 64 has aged well, but, you know, you were just comparing a 1996 game to a 2017 game, and of course, by Mario Odyssey, they're going to have refined the formula. You know, like, I would never even try to say that 64 can even go toe-to-toe with Odyssey. Its arms are too short to box with God, you know?
But at the same time, Super Mario Brothers, compared to Super Mario World, they control exactly the same. Right? Like, no one says, oh, the controls of the original Mario Brothers is terrible. No, they don't. Like, and that's a 10-year difference, almost, you know, 6-year difference between those two.
I would say there's movement differences between Super Mario Brothers and Super Mario World, just because, like, certain mechanics of how Mario can move did in fact change. You know, like, Mario World is a much faster, like, intensely faster game because, you know, you can jump higher, you can twirl down into enemies to continue your momentum and build it up. You know, like, in Mario Brothers, the original NES classic, you know, like, when you come down, you just kind of boop, you kind of flat come down until you run up again, you know, but in World, you launch yourself, and you've got to be really careful.
And that was the momentum that was built up throughout the games. My overall problem with this, though, is I feel like people put this on such a pedestal because of nostalgia glasses. It's the same way that people put GoldenEye on a pedestal. This people put WWF No Mercy on a pedestal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Listen, people. Those are shitty games too. I'm sorry. Someone has to tell you those games suck. I'm sorry. There's better games out there.
There are better games out there. I will not deny. GoldenEye has been succeeded by better first person shooters. And what was the other one you mentioned?
WWF No Mercy.
Yes, it has been succeeded by better wrestling games.
It's weird. The better wrestling game came out months before
WrestleMania 2000. Yes. That's a previous episode of ours. You should check it out. But, yo, listen, I get it. Nostalgia can be a painful kind of handicap on human memory. Maybe most of my defense is going to come from the fact that I've had very happy times associated with this game. I feel like what we have, you and I, have kind of successfully done in this podcast is we have very much, at times, managed to put nostalgia to the side. I feel like we have been able to critically look at old games. It's in our motto. We look at old games in a new light. But another important part of what I feel like is our mission statement, and I say this a lot on, like, our Twitch streams, is we try to talk about what the impact of a game was when it was released and how that may or may not have changed. And the thing with Mario 64 is that if I put aside all my happy memories of it, I still can't deny the impact that this game had. Now, we could talk about how it's aged, but again, we go back to 1996. Nothing was doing what this game was doing. You know, you made a joke on the stream tonight. You were like, when I'm done with this, I'm going to play a real platformer, Crash Bandicoot 4. I just want to go on a little spiel about this. Now, I have not played Crash Bandicoot 4. It's about time yet. I have no personal or critical opinion of it. But what I think is a little noteworthy is that this big return to form for Crash, this big celebrated, you know, back to its roots thing, is so firmly, you know, rooted in the past. And its past, just in my opinion, because I have played Crash 1 and I have played Super Mario 64, and you put the two games to the side, they're both fun. I think the first Crash Bandicoot is a lot of fun, but I also find the first Crash Bandicoot, you know, restrictive in ways that I don't find this because of its time period. You know, if I'm told you want to be able to go anywhere you can possibly go, or in one direction, I'm going to go, well, I want to try to go wherever I want. And Mario has evolved, I feel, whereas Crash, the fact that its big reboot is still stuck in its linear roots, it tells me that, like, Crash maybe can't evolve. And so, like, I think it's significant that Mario 64 made the impact that it did and that its franchise evolved in ways that other platformers of its kind didn't. So that's my long-winded spiel I was just on. I want to throw it back to you so we can talk. Let's talk about 1996,
yep.
Because I know you had a PlayStation growing up and you're a big Crash fan. So talk to me, like, what's the difference between Crash and Mario to you? What does it mean to you?
So, well, the difference between the two is Mario 64 was pretty much a constricted, claustrophobic open world game, right? Like, it was open world, but it was levels that were open world. It wasn't actual, it wasn't the whole game was open world. Crash Bandicoot wasn't an open world style, but it was a 3D platformer that could go, depending on the level, side scrolling or vertically going. So pretty much, you know, third person perspective. And I like that because it made you feel more in control of a platformer, where in Mario 64, it's so hard to judge the depth of anything in this game. And if you watch my playthroughs of it, you'll see, like, I hit a block and coins or a mushroom will come out of it. And I'm, like, running around trying to figure out where it's going to land, how it's going, how fast I can run up to grab it or anything like that. But let me go back to Mario 64 here.
Sure.
Yes, for the time in 1996, it was groundbreaking. It was unlike anything in its time. You know, the music to that game hit way more than anything did at that time. The style of the game, it was just that 3D platforming so polished compared to what we were experiencing and having. I made a joke about Bubsy 3D and stuff like that, right? Like, but this was a full-fledged, polished 3D platformer. While it had its problems due to limitations for being on a terrible console, it it did what it could do. And I won't fault it for that, for being groundbreaking and giving us, you know, Sunshine, giving us Odyssey, giving us 3D World, you know, all those other games. Like, I'm never going to, you know, poo-poo on it, right? Like, people put Ocarina of Time on such a high pedestal because of what it did. Yeah, but there's better Zelda games out there. Like,
I
understand. Like, I respect, that's the thing. I respect this game for what it did in the time. I just don't think it's good. That's the thing. Like, and that's, you know, people, listen, I don't like Nirvana, the band, but I respect them for what they did for music in the 90s. Like, it's, you can not like something, but still respect it, right? Case in point, Tom Brady. Like, that's like the modern day version of
the supervillain of football, but yes, who has undoubtedly seen incredible, you know, sport defining success. Sure,
right.
Sure. Even though he probably did completely cheat through several of those Super Bowls. But all right. So, okay, that's totally fair, and I get where you're coming from, because, yes, like, in similar regards, I have certain things where I feel the same way. It's like, X is important, but X isn't for me, you know? And so, that's totally fine. I think what's interesting that you brought up is you talked about the level of control that you felt like you had in Crash Bandicoot, with basically because of the perspectives that they locked you into. So from the reading I have done about the development of Super Mario 64, it kind of ties into how most, if not all, Mario games have ever been developed. They start with the mechanics first, and they don't build the rest of the game until they have the mechanics locked down. Mario Odyssey, the whole have a little thing that can control other, you know, elements in the world, that was decided very early, and they made sure that it was super refined, and then they built the globe-trotting game, like Adventure Vacation, around it. So Mario 64, the big thing, you know, was like Mario moving in 3D space. How are we going to do it? And if you recall, tonight you played the second Bowser level, which was kind of set in a lava world, and the first Bowser level, which you would remember from earlier in the game. So those were more traditionally fixed on straightforward paths. I remember in the stream you even brought it up. You were saying, like, in my opinion, the camera has to be this way because that's how I can see what's in front of me. And in my brain, I was like, Josh is putting the camera in a Crash Bandicoot perspective because that's how, you know, you were approaching the platforming of those levels. So those levels were some of the first initial concepts designed, and those were almost the complete style of the rest of the game. You know, that could have been what Mario 64 was worlds like that across the board, but they decided to get bigger with it. And Miyamoto is apparently on record as saying that the thing he spent the majority of time fussing with was the analog control. The worlds are big and roomy because they realized, you brought this up earlier, you talked about how the classic Mario games are all about pixel-perfect platforming. It's about nailing the timing, nailing the exact spot you're going to land on. But he realized in these big open worlds where you can move, you know, Mario in more directions than just, you know, up, middle, down, you know, like in his 2D life, his 3D life, you needed to give the players more room to land, to jump again, to kind of judge their distance. So that is what comes down to the development of how these levels are presented. And I just personally think that they nailed it. For me, just I personally think they nailed it because that openness gives you freedom to decide how you like to move Mario. I'm a big triple jumper, I'm a big long jumper. Like when I hop into levels, I'm immediately like ZA. I'm boosting through the level as fast as I can because I know I have the comfort to land wherever I want. And I respect that there is, you know, a craft and a skill to pixel perfect platforming, to being more precise with your timing. I just personally get a lot of satisfaction of knowing that, like, I can jump the way I want and still not have to suffer too big of a consequence for it, personally.
It's something about the 3D Mario games, right? There's the two exceptions that I always put on there, and that's Odyssey, and that would be 3D World. Because I think those two games, where 3D World is individual levels that are in an isometric or 3D-ish style, work. Odyssey, the open world mechanics and how smooth and tight the controls are. And that's the key word there. Odyssey has very tight controls, where 64 doesn't. I wanted to like this game when I went into it. And like I said, I went in with a clear mind, and there was some good stuff that I found, and I sometimes, you know, you can even see it in streams. I was enjoying some of the levels that I was playing, but tonight broke me.
I watched you break down live. Mary was also in the chat. She's enthusiastically in support of Mario 64 as well, but we were both just like shook when you were like, I tap out. I'm done.
Yeah.
It was one of the darkest sign-offs you've ever done. As heavily noted, Josh and I have been best friends for 15 years. You are one of the closest people I have a connection with in my life, sincerely. And I feel like, and I assume the same way with you, I feel like I know a lot of unspoken things about you, the way I assume you know a lot of unspoken things about me. And your passion for your declaration, which you said in the stream tonight, that Mario 3D World is the best 3D Mario game. I'm going to just go out on a shot here. And I think it's because the worlds are courses with set ending points. And that, I think, is just something you honestly enjoy. Now, a friend of the show, Dr. Lover, who has showed up in our streams, you know, they also they personally, not also, because I'm not comparing it directly to you, but they personally, they don't have a lot of fondness for kind of open world, you know, go as you please type of games. Like, they really didn't like Breath of the Wild because they were like, I don't like being dropped in. He's like, I like clearer goals. I like knowing paths a little more. Not that he wants every game to have the obnoxious Assassin's Creed, you know, lines on the ground that immediately direct you, but they don't like too much freedom either, personally. And from what I know about you and what your tastes are and what your preferences are, and especially your passion for old school kind of 2D pixel perfect platformers and their revivals like The Messenger, like Shovel Knight, I feel like you like games with clearer goals, not hand-holdy, but just with, you know, the intention is more direct. Whereas, you know, Mario 64 really does just give you kind of one word clues and then cuts you loose, you know, like get the star from the bird. And you're just, as you said, the Twitch, you're like, well, there's a bird, but is it that bird? Cause it's not clear. You know, like, do you think I'm on point or do you think I'm exaggerating?
Yeah, you're pretty close. You're pretty close to that because I am not a huge fan of open world games. You know, when it comes to Assassin's Creed, when it comes to RPGs, when it comes to a whole bunch of stuff, like there's certain games that I'll play, like Spider-Man, the Arkham games, stuff like that. But yeah, my problem is like, oh, well, my goal is over here. And, you know, I've made this known for a long time that I hate Red Dead Redemption. And it's because of the same thing. It's like, hey, get on your horse and go ride over here. However, you got to pick up 13 different flowers on your way over there. And then you're going to see that there's a spittoon can that you got to spit into 3 times. If you don't do that, though, you're going to lose the poker game. Like,
those two examples are always your go-to dunks on Red Dead. And I keep telling you, like, the flowers are optional. Like, it's a side quest. That's. But anyway, go ahead.
But that's the thing, though. Everything technically in this game is optional, like you said. Only what's being told to you is your main objective, right? And that, that was a problem, too. Because, like you said, from the start of the first level, you can get the 6-star.
Yes.
Right? But you didn't know that there were 6 stars, right?
Nope.
So that's something that makes me really that made me really upset. Like, just give me the list of them. Like Tony Hawk, Pro Skater. Give me the list of tasks that I need to do. And then just let me go figure out what I want to do.
Okay. I'm not going to lie. That's an interesting thing up top. Yeah. That's a pretty intriguing suggestion. I'm not going to lie. You know, you drop in a bomb battlefield and it doesn't outright tell you where everything is. But similar to Tony Hawk, it kind of gives you fleeting glimpses. And it's like, you know what you're supposed to do. Go figure it out. So, okay.
And then,
I agree with you on that.
When we were playing tonight in Dire Lake.
Just so you don't get hammered in the chat or the comments, it's Dire Docs.
Dire Docs. Sorry.
Okay, I'm just looking out for you.
But I went in, got the first star, then I went back in to get the next star, and I got like star 3 or star 4, and I'm like, well, what the hell am I doing? There was what, 12, 15 levels in this game, one of those two, I think. And
there are 15 worlds. There are a number of hidden stars around the castle. So, yeah.
So, 15 worlds and 120, like, you're looking at about 6-7 per world. Right? Yes. And I would guess, so, is there 7 in each one?
Yes, there are 6 primary stars, and then if you collect 100 coins, you get the 7th
okay,
star.
Okay, so that, I didn't know that. Okay. But, like, that, they... The levels didn't make me want to go back in every time. Okay. Like, just the layouts to them, I was just like, I'm just so, I don't know, just, I felt bored almost with most of them. Like, the lava level, right? You can see the entire map from where you're at because it's a very flat level, except for going when you go inside the volcano. And don't get me started with getting that one when you had to go inside and...
The volcano is bad. Look here, I'll stand up for you. The volcano in Lethal Lava Land that you have to jump into, and then you have to kind of... There's 2 stars within the interior, I believe, that focus around, you know, winding around the interior of the volcano, either on narrow ledges or on a floating platform. And the camera, which has been criticized in the years since this game has released, and which I kind of feel I have mastered to a degree, The camera's unforgiving in that one because it can't do the full breadth of everything. So yeah, Volcano Lethal Lava Land, it's bad. I have managed to kind of perfectly get my way up those platforms and then miss one pull and then have to start the whole thing over again.
Right.
So
it's because of the way that the camera is, with the way that he controls it, you can't judge the depth of how far you're jumping or where you're jumping at, which is once again goes back to the way that he just controls in this game. That was the part that got me. And inside of the Hazy Maze, when you
Hazy
had
Maze Cave, yep.
When you had to get the red coins and you're on that platform and you have to move that platform around and break the things, and that was frustrating.
I'll just say this, that frustrated me as a kid as well. I won't even begin to say that, oh, maybe it just aged poorly. That's something I didn't enjoy as a kid because of how precise that was and how easy it was to screw up.
I am surprised that I got as far as I did. I didn't think I was going to get far at all because I was just going to get so frustrated with everything. And I was like, I got a little over halfway to my goal. But
you did. So you only need 70 stars to unlock the final Bowser world. And if you defeat him, you hit the end credits and the game's over. But there are 120 stars that are collectible in this game, top to bottom. And the kind of reward, if you don't know, Josh, the reward for getting 120 is that a cannon in the castle courtyard will unlock. And if you shoot yourself up to the top of the castle, you'll find Yoshi there. And Yoshi will greet you and congratulate you on your success, and then he'll give you 100 lives. So you can go and just kind of freewheel through the levels all you want and not have to worry about a game over.
And so you have to get 50 more stars after you beat the game for him to give you 100 lives after you beat the game.
It's not a great prize.
It's the Banjo-Kazooie prize, right? We're going to give you, for getting all the stuff in Banjo-Kazooie, we're going to give you this thing that you could have used towards the beginning of the game at the very end of it.
That's an interesting point, yeah. No, yeah, the encouragement that I see it as is like, because you can redo the courses to your heart's content. You know, you can go back and beat King Babam or race Koopa the Quick or race the Penguin. You know, you can do that all you want. So my view of it as, we give you 100 lives, you can go on these adventures all you want over and over again and never have to worry about getting a game over. But again, yes, there is a little bit less of an appeal to the fact that you get it when you should be done. It's like, what am I going to do with these?
Yeah, I completed the game. Now they want me to go back and just hang out. It's kind of weird.
All right. So here's what I want to do. I want to play a little game. We're going to go one back and forth one at a time. I want you to say three positive things about the game that aren't the music. And I'm going to say and I'm going to say three negative things. I'm going to match each of your positives with a negative from me. And, you know, just to kind of be broad and, you know, as open-minded as we can be. So Josh, I'd like you to start.
Number one, the Boo House. That entire level. That was 100% worth it. It's the most enjoyable level in the game. And it scared me. I'm sorry. The piano got me. On our stream, when I was playing it, I was...
I agree with you that Boo's Haunted House is one of the most well-designed and fun levels in the game. You know, I've been talking about exploration and openness, you know, for a contained house. There's so much to explore and so much to find in
there. Except for getting to the third story. That was terrible.
It is quite...
It's a very terrible
challenging.
Jump. Yeah, it's a very terrible
quite
jump.
Quite challenging. All right, so my negative, I would have to say, are the later level endgame courses. And I know you didn't get to them, but there are the final kind of two courses before Bowser's final showdown are TikTok Clock and Rainbow Cruise. And these are the more disjointed, precision-based levels in the game that honestly conflict with that big, wide-open safety net I was talking about with earlier levels. You know, you're talking about pixel perfectness, but here we are in worlds that are just... in Rainbow Cruise, it's the cheese wheels from Sackboy just basically spinning in an open sky, and you've got a perfectly timed jumps between those and these magic carpets that disappear if you get off them for too long, and wooden platforms that drop out. Like, it's supposed to be a curve, it's supposed to be a payoff of your skill, but I think it is a shocking disconnect from the way previous levels had been set up. So yeah, the later level courses in this game take the challenge into a mismatched direction. I'll say that.
Number two, I would say all the hidden stuff in the game. I actually liked that a lot because it made me want to explore the castle more, whether it's going and finding where the little switch blocks are, or draining the water in the moat out front, or walking into a wall that just transported me to a different world. Like,
yep,
all that kind of weird stuff and hidden stuff. You know, when I went to the third world, the water one, there's the little
Jolly Roger.
There's like little like squares in the top corners, and if you did like the backwards jump, you could land inside of it, and it would take you to somewhere else. And like that stuff, I really enjoyed because it made you want to explore the castle more rather than the actual worlds themselves, because the castle almost seemed like it's its own world, its own being.
Oh, I agree. I believe it is personally. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. My second negative, it's something I mentioned before way early at the top of the episode, but it's the fact that getting a star kicks you out and you got to go back into the level. It's something that, like, once I had tried Banjo-Kazooie's way of doing it, where you can get as many as you want within the same level, I'm like, how can I go back? How can you? I get why. I understand, and I explained earlier, I get that they kind of have to reset the challenges, but it's not great. Not for me. So that's a big gripe for me.
The humor is my third. I thought the humor to some of the signposts, to some of the characters, the way that they talk, I think that really fit. It was a nice change, because like when you think of Mario, it's very cut and dry. Save the princess, beat the bad guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, and then like some of these characters had like character to them. Like some of them had like weird emotions and stuff like that. Like the Ba-bombs. The pink Ba-bombs are like, hey, yeah, well, we're good.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the humor to them itself. So
my third negative is Snowman Land. It is the second winter based level in this game after Cool Cool Mountain, which you should have played based off of your gameplay. That's the one with the penguins in it.
Yep.
Snowman Land's a snow level based around a giant snowman at the center. And I think it's the worst level in the game. I think it's kind of like, here's all the ideas that we couldn't fit into Cool Cool Mountain. Let's just throw them all together into a winter level, even though they don't cohesively fit together. I don't think it's very fun to explore because it's too small. It's very small in comparison to some of the other big open levels. And its challenges are either way too easy or way too hard. There's like a hidden igloo that you really are going to have trouble getting to until you've played the game for, you know, many, many occasions. There's like other levels where like they present a star and it's like, ooh, it's in an optical illusion. How are you going to get to it? But then you can get to it pretty easily. And then it's like, oh, that wasn't challenging at all. So Snowman Land, bad level. Don't like it.
I just, like I said, I keep going back to the music in this game. And it's just so great. I mean, on my phone, my phone's ringtone is the main song of the game.
Like, right. So if I'm correct, it's the So what's interesting is for like a long time I didn't have it clear in my head that like that's the track that plays when you go to Bomb Bomb Battlefield for the first time, and it repeats in several other levels as the music for those worlds. But that is like classified like on the soundtrack as Super Mario 64 main theme.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that is the main tune. I also love it. Whenever I play a Smash Brothers game and like you can select the music, I usually will set that to appear as high as I can. This video game music cover band that does games in like a funk jazz style called Super Soul Bros, they have an incredible version of that I listen to whenever I can. yeah, music, especially that song, is great. What other tracks did you like?
The water theme.
Okay.
Rivals. It doesn't take over. It rivals Donkey Kong Country's underwater theme.
Oh, that's pretty bold. Yes, I know Mary is a big fan of the music for water levels in this game as well. The very kind of cool hunting. The da-da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Yeah.
Even when I'm in Hazy Maze and it was a remix of 1-2 where it was the like, I was like, okay, like I like that they also incorporated the original themes into the music. Like, everything music wise in this game was great. Even like when the satisfactory noise of getting a star, like it felt good when you got one. But the music to a game can't make me like the game. it's
sure, because you could just listen to the soundtrack. Yeah, I understand completely. Right.
I would put it up there as a really good soundtrack in my list of video game soundtracks.
Okay, good to note. But, all right, that's fine. Yeah, I get it completely. You can, a video game can't live on music alone unless, you know, it's Guitar Hero. But I see where you're coming from.
So
our usual. Oh, go ahead.
I want to ask you a question now.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
If you played Odyssey before you played this, would you feel the same way?
Well, that's a very difficult question, but I probably wouldn't because, yeah, like, I played Ocarina of Time before I played any of the 2D Zeldas. And I have a real hard time getting into the 2D Zeldas. I really do. And, you know, I say this a lot when I talk about Breath of the Wild with friends or anything. Like, I'm replaying Breath of the Wild right now. I can't see myself going back willingly to playing old Zelda games now, unless I have to do it for the show. Because those games just seem like from 100 years ago now compared to everything I can do in Breath of the Wild. I can't go back. So, yes, there are some points where games just age so incredibly poorly that they literally should just be in a museum. But I still think it's important to go to museums and learn your history. So, like, Josh, you said in the chat you were very upset. You were talking about, and by in the chat, I mean in the Twitch, you were very upset talking about how the Switch Mario 64 release didn't have any quality of life improvements. And I said, it's not about that. It's about preserving history, warts and all. And, I don't think you agreed with me. But here's the thing. Like,
I said, what about Wart from Mario 2?
You did. You did. That's right.
And he's long forgotten.
Lost to history, he is, yes. So here's where I'm at. Like, there's only been a couple times Nintendo has actually remade games, like strict remake from the ground up. The couple notable instances are Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask on the 3DS. And in Majora's Mask's case, they really messed that game up. In attempting to modernize and give it quality of life improvements, they made it too easy in certain cases, too hard in others, and really just kind of destroyed a lot of the things that made it unique. And that's why I would never want to see a remake of Mario 64. You know, a lot of people talk about it. A lot of people demand it. They're like, oh, remake's in the works. Oh, they're going to remake it. And I'm like, why do you want that? Like, Odyssey is in every way a bigger and better game than Mario 64. If you want an updated Mario game, go play that.
But
Go ahead.
But yeah. Samus Returns, Metroid 2.
Okay. You are correct. That's another one that escaped my mind. It's weird that it mostly seems to be on the handhelds that these get released. So, okay, that's an exception, but I think it's an exception that proves the rule because it stands alone, whereas all the other ones are very slippery and very, I don't want to ever see this get remade because I think it would probably be ruined or probably be made so easy that it'd just be like, I think people even more than you would be like, why do people like this? It's too easy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, let's look at it. Okay. People say that this is such a perfect game, right? That's why people have to break the game to be able to enjoy it, to do all these speed runs on it, because they want to get the game over and done with as fast as possible.
I'm sure there's more to it than that. But you know, when I just to get real quick, because I just had this analogy with Mario Sunshine, you know,
yeah,
if they had pumped quality of life improvements into these games, Sunshine included, like, would we have been able today to have the kind of honest conversations we're having now about these games? If they fixed Mario Sunshine, I wouldn't have realized that Mario Sunshine actually has aged poorly, you know? Like,
well,
if they remade it, I wouldn't be able to, like, I'm glad that 3D All-Stars, more or less, with the exception of, you know, Galaxy having to adapt for the Joy-Cons, I'm honestly happy that most of them are presented as they were, because you could sit and go, oh, yes, like, I get where this came from and how gaming has evolved from here, and I think that's important.
But isn't that why you're making me play the GameCube version of Wind Waker?
Yeah, because I want you to re-experience
it. Because the quality of life things that have happened on the Wii U, like, there, you can always go back.
But I have admitted, I've probably admitted on a stream or a cast of this show, that while I love Wind Waker and think it's really good, Wind Waker has a major third act problem with its treasure map nonsense, and I want you to experience that so you can see where I'm coming from. How Wind Waker is like a 9.5 out of 10, because that 0.5, the gap just could have been closed right there, you know? But they didn't. Also, you need to get back to streaming that.
I know.
You need to get back to streaming.
I know.
I won. I predicted Steve. The Jazz Singer. It's the first movie that ever had like synced sound, so that the characters were actually talking without title cards. 1927. There's a significant amount of characters in blackface in that movie. It is a historic achievement in the history of film that I think if you want to seriously appreciate the art of film, you should watch. But it's bad because of things it does in its design, i.e. characters in blackface. Do I want a 2020 remake? I know there's been a remake of it, but do I want a 2020 remake of The Jazz Singer that, like, quality of life improves?
Starring Neil Diamond.
I mean, yes, you're right. But, like, the Model T is not a car I would drive today, but I appreciate the Model T for what it is. Mario 64 is not a Mario game that I would say, you get what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like,
I think
it's important for classics to be played and played the way they were released. I'm not calling The Jazz Singer a classic. I know it's got problems. Please don't yell at me. I'm saying Mario 64 doesn't have blackface, therefore it's better than The Jazz Singer. Bear, boom, I did it. I got it all together. Yeah.
Yeah. I presume that you would recommend this game to people, right?
In 2020, I would say that you should check out this game again for the sake of gaming history. I would not say to buy 3D All-Stars, even though I own it.
It's not that great. I'll be honest. It's not that great.
Like, listen, if you're, I feel like when I say I would recommend this to people who want to be up on gaming history, those are the kind of gamers who are probably going to go to, like, to find a used game store or a pawn shop and hunt themselves down an N64 and a copy of this. And I say that's great. That's probably the best way to experience it. Yes. You know, if you are a millennial in our age range who wants to kind of experience again, I personally feel like you're going to find the same joy in the game if you go back to it. But if it's 2020 and you're looking to play a Mario game for the first time, I can't in all honest good conscience tell you to start with this one. But it is one you should get around to. But I love it, and I will play this game again. I totally will.
You should,
with all the things I've said
about
it.
You should play it for historical purposes. But other than that, like, don't go out of your way to play it if you have experienced something better.
Odyssey exists.
Right.
Mario Galaxy exists. Those are my top two. My top three Mario games. I think we've been over this on the cast before, but I think the three best Mario games ever made are Mario Odyssey, Mario Galaxy, and Super Mario World. I think those are the three best. And you know, I would in a heartbeat tell somebody to go do Galaxy and Odyssey and, you know, World before 64. Personally.
I think a problem with Mario in general, and I didn't even get into it with the things I hated. I think there's just the gimmicks are really what turns me off with a lot of the Mario games.
Well, what gimmicks did you feel like this game had?
The hat with the wings, that had the worst controls out of anything in this entire game. It didn't make sense how to control it. But gimmicks and Mario aside,
you didn't like Metal Mario?
It was all right.
You didn't like T-1000 Mario being able to just...
I did make that joke in this stream.
Steamroll through baddies and just make them go poof.
No, I can't recommend it.
When I was in grade school, I had a folder with Metal Mario on it, and like it was kind of like a raised metallic like thing to it. And I was like, whenever I had tests and they were like, put your folders up so people can't see your answers, I'd be like, here's my Mario folder. I was a very popular, well liked kid, Josh.
Yeah. I can tell. But no,
everyone loved me.
I couldn't recommend you play this game, but I can definitely recommend you to listen to the soundtrack.
Fair enough. I disagree completely. I think you are a filthy boy. But that's what you get for having an opinion. Am I right?
Yes. An opinion in 2020. How dare I?
So this is the last episode of the show. Josh and I aren't friends anymore. No. But tell us, you know, of course, what you think about Mario 64 in either the comments of this YouTube video or in any of our social media spheres. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We have an Instagram account that's just floating out the ether, but we kind of realize it's kind of pointless to promote an audio-based thing on a picture-based platform like Insta, so we haven't really been using it. But Josh, where else can they find us out there?
You can find us
world?
On twitch.tv/castofthepass, youtube.com/castofthepass, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Deezer, Audio Boom, anywhere you can get audio podcast formats, we're there.
We are
the Flux Capacitor with the Triforce logo in it. And
Triflux Capacitor, baby.
I think we're closing in on 3 years of this. Right
well,
now?
Trying to think. We launched in September 2018. We launched the Cast of the Past. So that's how long, you know, yeah. In next September, we'll be in our third year. We've been podcasting since 2017 when we originally started as Three to Play Games with, you know, friend of the show, Brian. So... yeah, it's been a really long, interesting haul. This will be our last regular game-based episode of the year. Stay tuned. On December 31st, New Year's Eve, we're going to release our Best of 2020 episode, where we're going to talk about the best 2020 games and the best older games that we played in 2020. And as you imagine, we had lots of time, so we'll be talking about some interesting titles.
Yeah, I think my last count, I was 44 games I beat this year.
Nice.
I definitely lived up to my New Year's resolution of playing more games.
Look at that. Just not the way you expected, am I right?
No. But until next time, this has been Josh.
And Tom.
And we'll see you in the future. Well, that's all the time that we can spend in the past, so thanks for listening. Subscribe to A Cast of the Past on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And stay up to date with A Cast of the Past by making sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you can be the first to know when new episodes drop, as well as joining in on discussions on all things gaming. And until next time, we'll see you in the future.